I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. President Obama is in Cuba, the first American president to visit that country since Calvin Coolidge in 1928. The two nations restored relations in 2014 with Pope Francis assisting as a go-between and opened embassies in each other's capitals last summer. The president has loosened some travel and trade restrictions while the U.S. embargo remains in place. It's unlikely that Congress will lift it during an election year. Members of a Cuban dissident group, Ladies in White, were arrested yesterday, and last month more than 1,400 protesters and human rights activists were detained for brief periods of time in Cuba. On President Obama's agenda today, a meeting with Cuban President Raul Castro and a state dinner, and tomorrow, a speech to the Cuban people, a meeting with dissidents, and taking in a baseball game between the Cuban national team and the Tampa Bay Rays. Then it's off to Argentina. In this hour of Radio Times, we talk about the significance of this visit, the risks, the pitfalls, what it means for the U.S., and what it means for Cuba. And we have two guests who have joined us. Here in our Philadelphia studio is John Grunbeck Tedesco. He's an associate professor and convener of American Studies at Ramapo College in New Jersey, author of Cuba, the United States, and Cultures of the Transnational Left. And John, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And joining us from the NPR studios in New York is Christopher Sabatini. He's a professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, also director of a new research institute called Global Americans. And Christopher Sabatini, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks, Marty. Great to be here.
John, let me begin with you, only because we actually have started this conversation for about 10 minutes off the air. I turned on my TV yesterday to watch Air Force One touchdown at Havana Airport and seeing the first family coming out and, of course, all the entourage that came with them, all those big cars that provide the security for the president. How significant is this visit?
Oh, I think it's very significant. It's hugely symbolic, certainly. It shows that the United States is serious about reconciliation and that all that has transpired in the past 16 or so months is meant to bode well in the future of relations between countries. Of course, what is left to be seen is what will happen when Air Force One then leaves. What will happen on the island? How will this affect Cuban politics this year, in the coming years, and certainly down the road?
To you, Chris, the same kind of question. Does this turn the page? It's been turning, I guess, incrementally. Chris, does this turn the page on U.S.-Cuba relations?
It does, partially. And clearly, we've got two forces at work here. One is Obama wants to leave a legacy. What he did in 2014 was basically begin to change the embargo through executive action. But the embargo remains law, as you mentioned, Marty. So the question is could another president come in, a Republican president in particular, come in and change that? So he wants to double down on this policy and wants to set it in stone and consolidate it. And that also represents a sea change in U.S. politics. We saw Marco Rubio lose the Florida primaries for Republicans, and that indicates that there's also a change in the Cuban-American sentiment that has supported this embargo. And then in Cuba, we're looking at, you know, a real possible change after 50 years of revolution. The two Castro brothers are, well, they're getting up there in years. Mm-hmm. Fidel will turn 90 in August. Raul is 83 or 84. And Raul has said he'll step down in 2018. So, you know, this past of enmity and personal enmity in many cases, and also the Cold War policy is certainly ending. The question is, what comes next?
Well, to you, John, and to you, Chris, as well, I mean, could it be fairly said that the Castro brothers won this 50-plus year standoff in that they are still in power? The embargo did not dislodge them from power. The Obama administration is not interested in regime change, so did they win this? To you, John.
Well, I think they'll sit back and think that they've been able to secure a legacy for their country, and that revolution is a big part of that. But what history will be written in 50 years, we also don't know. One of the issues that this generation is facing, the Castro generation, is a increasingly growing group of Cubans that are young, younger than 30, younger than 35. So the question becomes what to do with this increasingly marginalized constituency, important constituency within within Cuba that would rather be connected to 21st century technology, would rather have some of the freedoms that everyone over the world enjoys. And so that group is ideologically distant from the generation of their grandparents. And so now what the Cuban government is facing is what will come next in order to prevent further exodus from the island.
And apparently the exodus has continued and perhaps even surpassed the exodus of 1959.
Yeah, well, you know, some 2 million or so people in the United States claim Cuban heritage. So, you know, there are major waves of Cuban exiles coming since 1960. I mean, the first major ones came between 1959 and 1962, and the next significant one was 1980 with the Mariel boatlift. And then finally in 1993, 94, you had waves of balseros or Cuban rafters that came. And those numbers, the exact numbers are not known, but most people think that is between 30 and 40,000 Cubans that came over at that time.
Chris, can you talk about some of the dissidents, some of the human rights activists? I mentioned the ladies in white, but there are others who have been protesting against their government. The president is supposed to meet with some of them tomorrow. I don't have a lot of details here, but how should we understand what the dissidents are telling us about Cuba?
You know, there's two generations of dissidents, and that's important as well. On the one hand, there are a number of, like Jose Daniel Ferrer, who is going to be meeting with the president, Elizardo Sanchez, who is a longtime human rights activist and has collected a lot of the reports of the recent crackdown on dissidents, including the 1,400 or so detentions that occurred in February of dissidents. And then there's also a new generation. John sort of alluded to that in the Cuba general context, but it's true also in the dissident community. A new generation represented by Joanny Sanchez and others who are not so much oriented towards the exterior and also playing to Cuban Americans in South Florida, but are also addressing sort of Cubans' needs, creating independent media, blogging, looking at issues of sort of basic sort of local politics, filling potholes, addressing sort of labor needs in specific factories. And that's an interesting phenomenon as well, because it demonstrates that Cuban dissidents are now looking at sort of the social failings of the Cuban regime and the economic failings of the Cuban regime. And I think Obama, you know, many of these dissidents, for all their courage and their long work on this issue, don't have a lot of resonance within Cuba. Part of that is also some of them, as I mentioned, play more to the South Miami crowd, and so are very supportive of the embargo, which is kind of funny because the embargo in Cuba is not very popular. It plays well in South Miami, but it doesn't play so well in Cuba. Obama's going to meet with all of them in the embassy, or a number of them. I think it's going to be an interesting discussion. They even ones that have opposed his changes to the embargo will be there at the meeting. And I think it's an important, you know, symbolic show of U.S.'s principled commitment to human rights and democracy. But there's also another side to this that Obama is sort of giving a greater show to, and that is his meeting with entrepreneurs, which will occur
today, right?
Today, yes. And that's really, in many ways, a long-term bet. What we've seen as a result of Raul's incremental changes on economic controls in Cuba is the emergence of a new, entrepreneurial class in Cuba that is, you know, investing in their homes, opening up bed and breakfasts, creating computer shops and so on. And that's important for the long-term, if you will, soft landing of Cuban political and economic change, and that these are people that are gaining sort of an economic space against the regime. And in many ways, I think, you know, that is what has made these changes so possible and viable, because the Cuban government itself has endorsed a lot of these economic changes.
And it seems that the president saying, I'll put this to you, John, is that through trade, through openness, through a relaxation of restrictions, will bring about some of these freedoms that people in Cuba have said that they have wanted. I mean, I guess this will be an interesting test case.
I think that's what the Obama administration is hoping for. And really, it's beyond the scope of what Obama can predict, right? I mean, he's in his remaining months in office. But I think using the rationale, and it may not be the correct rationale, but there is a rationale that as more Americans come with cell phones, with Facebook, with Twitter, and record the day-to-day life in Cuba, that that will bring about a different public conversation that is not possible right now under the tight control of media, which is loosening but still mm-hmm. tight in Cuba. And that, that mark opening the market will then open open up ways of communication that will help to alleviate some of the human rights questions. But just as an added note, you know, the Cuban government will come back and say, look, if we're abusers of human rights, why are we on the United Nations Human Rights Council as a member state? So there's pushback. I think, you know, the Cubans are very proud people and will say, you know, we've got this record, and we wouldn't be a member state, you know, if if we were in violation.
The president is meeting with dissidents. He will be speaking to the country tomorrow. Perhaps I'll put it this way to you, John, and then to you, Chris, which is, what would you like the president to say about dissidents or to dissidents as he meets with them?
Oh, I think he's going to say that, you know, as the lead representative of the United States, that he's an advocate of First Amendment liberties, and that he will be pushing Cuba to sort of adhere to democratic freedoms that, you know, are enjoyed worldwide. And I think the president will also use the regional argument that Cuba is now coming out of isolation in the Western Hemisphere. And that part of engaging Cuba in regional politics will mean that Cuba will need to become much more transparent in some of these issues.
What do you say, Chris?
I think that's right. I think John has a good point. I think he'll frame it in regional issues. One of the things that I think has been disappointing, and I say this as a human rights activist, is the lack of regional attention on human rights abuses inside Cuba. We understand that the embargo is not very popular, but that has been used as an excuse for a long time by many of our best allies in the region from speaking out about human rights concerns inside Cuba. Now the question is, we have a president who has whittled away at the embargo, demonstrated his distaste for it. The question is, will other governments stand up and speak out in favor of human rights, stand shoulder by shoulder with these dissidents? Because it's undeniable, whether it's Human Rights Watch or whether it's questions of the Inter-American Commission for Human Rights, there are human rights abuses in Cuba. It remains a repressive regime. So, you know, I think Obama will try to sort of frame this in a larger context and also demonstrate that this is sort of about U.S. principles, that you can, in fact, be against the embargo, but still be in favor of human rights at the same time. And because of the embargo and because of the very polarized politics within the United States and in the region, that hasn't often been done. It's either been an either or. You're either for the embargo in the U.S. and therefore for human rights, or you're against the embargo and don't really want to raise human rights. I think he's going to try to meld those two positions and try to raise that with dissidents and try to show a certain amount of, if you will, sort of neutral, nonpartisan solidarity with human rights activists, not just in Cuba, but the world over.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about what just about the world is talking about today. This is President Obama's historic visit to Cuba, and that's Christopher Sabatini. Also with us, John Gronbeck-Tedesco, and we have a third guest, David Rennie, who'll be joining us after this very short break. 1-888-477-9499. We want to know where you stand on this visit to Cuba. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, we're talking about President Obama's historic visit to Cuba. He and his family and an entourage arriving yesterday. We've been talking about the nature of this visit, U.S.-Cuba relations. And again, our guests are Christopher Sabatini, professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, director of a new research institute called Global Americans. He's joining us from the NPR studios in New York. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is John Gronbeck-Tedesco, an associate professor, convener of American Studies at Ramapo College of New Jersey, author of Cuba, the United States, and Cultures of the Transnational Left. And joining us now by telephone is David Rennie, and he's Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And David Rennie, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hello.
We have just spent the last 15, 20 minutes or so just talking about the historic nature of this visit of the U.S. president to Cuba. Any just quick response you want to have to that? And then I do want to talk a bit more about the embargo and the Cuban economy.
Well, it's fascinating seeing the degree to which this visit has galvanized kind of political watchers in Washington. It's a big deal, even though the presidential election has been sucking up a lot of the energy. It's a reminder that even in his last few months as president, Barack Obama can still do things that have a chance of leaving a legacy, a kind of a reminder that he's still here and that we don't have to spend our entire lives worrying about Donald Trump and the other presidential candidates.
What do you hope, though, or what do you think he can accomplish by this couple-day visit to Cuba?
Clearly, he's making a bet, and the Cuban government is making a bet in completely the opposite direction. He's making a bet that by visiting now, perhaps before he had, you know, every single guarantee that some of his opponents would like him to have obtained from the Cubans, that he's setting something in stone that can't be reversed, that an American president walking around the streets of old Havana, speaking to the Cuban public tomorrow on television, will just change things irreversibly and do away with the kind of, as he would see it, stalemate Cold War confrontation of the embargo. The Cubans are betting the exact opposite. The Cubans are betting that, as we saw, they were locking up dissidents or detaining dissidents as his plane, Air Force One, was even in the air. The ladies in white, they did their usual right. Sunday protest. And they're betting that they can be like China, I guess, that they can have relations with the outside world, they can have American presidents visit, but they won't need to fundamentally dismantle their one-party system. And the big bet is that actually they're wrong, that they're 90 miles off the coast of Florida, and that once you have millions of American tourists and American investors and that American influence, they simply will not be able to maintain what they've kept going for half a century.
Let me pick up on that and some things that were said earlier in the hour. I'll go to you, John. And this embargo is in place, but just how airtight is it? The president has used his authority to lift some restrictions, allowing more trade and more travel to Cuba.
Yeah, but there's only so much that the president can do. This will take congressional action to lift the embargo that was put in place by Congress. It solidified in the 1990s, solidified what had historically been an embargo headed by the White House, different administrations since John F. Kennedy had used the executive office to basically leverage a financial embargo. So it's out of the Department of Treasury. Congress solidified some of those practices in the 1990s. So conventional wisdom says that Congress will need to act. Will that happen in these remaining months? Probably not. Mm-hmm. So I've been struck by how much Obama has been able to do as president in terms of opening avenues for everyday Americans to go to Cuba. But at some point, he'll face some congressional resistance, even though there is by and large bipartisan support for reconciliation.
And there are a couple of Republicans who have gone with the president to Cuba. Not a lot, but a handful. Chris, if I can go to you, and I mean, Cuba has depended for a while on the Soviet Union to keep its economy afloat, Venezuela to keep its economy afloat. Is it in dire economic shape today?
Well, you know, this goes to the point, Marty, that you raised earlier about who can claim victory in this sort of change. And I think both sides are going to try to claim victory, and there's an element of truth in both of their claims. On the Cuba side, Obama's trip does recognize, it's not a surrender, as some critics would say, but it does recognize that the Castro regime has endured for 50 years, that it may very well set the pace and tone of its own transition away from the Castros to another element. And on the other side, Obama is clearly claiming that, you know, that they're sort of recognized in the U.S. and welcoming the president demonstrates in many ways their own economic need, because they were dependent. They were effectively a client state of the Soviet Union till the 90s. When the Soviet Union collapsed, they went through what they call their special period, in which their GDP collapsed, contracted by multiples of 10. And then they found a new benefactor in Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. And he and his successor, Nicolas Maduro, have provided Cuba with 100,000 barrels of oil a day, half of which they consume themselves and the other half they sell on the international market. But that is drying up for two reasons. First of all, the price of oil has dropped from 120 barrels to around $28 now. But also, of course, if you look at just, you know, across the Caribbean, Venezuela right now with inflation raging around 200%, contraction economically around 10%, that giveaway isn't going to last for long. And so clearly, Raul Castro is looking for ways to keep the revolution afloat, if you will, economically. Mm. And he's seeking to cozy up to the United States in some ways on his own terms. But I think many people recognize that as an admission of failure of the Cuban Revolution, at least in economic terms. And that's is why I think Obama can claim this is somewhat of a victory.
Well, David, there are some budding entrepreneurs in Cuba opening up their homes to be restaurants, to provide lodging for tourists. Do you see the Cuban economy embracing a kind of capitalism going forward?
Well, they've been doing this, with Paladares private restaurants and allowing now Airbnb to operate for quite some time, but it's been through gritted teeth and incredibly reluctantly. I think one thing that you hear from American officials and people who worked in the first term of the Obama administration is this embargo was never watertight. Don't forget, there's been tons and tons of money, not just from Venezuela, but also from Europe. From Canada, a huge investor, tons of Canadian tourists on the beach resorts there. But that investment hasn't really fundamentally changed the nature of Cuba or the way that Cuba does business and that kind of lock of the state on their own country. One of the things you hear from optimists, including some people I interviewed last week who worked in the first term of the Obama administration, now in think tank land in Washington, is the Castros will die eventually. There will be a transition. You'll see a new generation of leaders rising up. And in that transition, people in America, in Washington, who follow Cuba, worry that the bad path for Cuba to follow would be something like Russia or some of those former Soviet republics, where you go straight from state control of the economy into kind of oligarch corrupt capitalism. And that one of the values of having Americans there, not to be too Pollyannaish about American businessmen, they're not all saints, but American businessmen, when they operate abroad, they do have to obey pretty strict American laws on not bribing foreign officials, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They also have to have pretty strict rules on transparency, certainly compared to, say, Chinese companies or even quite a lot of European companies. So the idea is that by lifting as much of the embargo as they can, and clearly your other called is absolutely right. Congress is not about to change the fundamental law underpinning the embargo, but you can see investors being given licenses by the Treasury, by the administration to go in. The idea is that American businessmen just spread a bit more transparency and a bit more kind of probity into the Cuban economy, and that could be tremendously important if you're an optimist in shaping a transition.
Well, I don't want to get too off target here, but John, I was also thinking about the anti-trade rhetoric that's coming out of the presidential campaign from really both Republicans and Democrats, and whether how that in any way gets factored into whatever trade deals Cuba establishes with the United States or vice versa.
I think that's probably a good point that'll be raised later on. I think right now on the forefront of most people's minds is the question of markets. I mean, one of the reasons, for instance, certain Republican leaders have been open to some sort of diplomatic rapprochement in the past years is because they are leaders in states that have large agrarian markets and would love to be able to sell foodstuff to Cuba, more of it.
And Cuba needs it, apparently.
And Cuba needs
some food.
It. Yeah. And so those kinds of things have bipartisan approval, telecommunications, things of this nature, looking for that market. I think the interesting question is, though, what will the Cuban government allow? I think the Cuban government has shown that it's hesitant to simply open up its arms and openly embrace American market capitalism. I think it's probably a little weary of what could happen if too much happened too soon. It could possibly destabilize the internal workings of the country. You certainly have a large underclass, predominantly Afro-Cuban, mixed-race Cubans, that are looking for economic betterment. And it's not clear that American markets will necessarily bring that, those financial rewards because of internal racial politics that still govern the island, although the Cuban government has since the 1960s said that it has successfully ridded the country of racism. Obviously, what happens on the ground is something entirely different. So what potentially too much could really unsettle what the Cuban government is seeing itself as trying to do. And I actually think that the Cuban government does not exactly know what's going to happen in the coming years after Raul Castro steps down.
That's John Gronbeck Tedesco. Joining us along with Christopher Sabatini and David Rennie, we are talking about the president's historic visit to Cuba, Air Force One touching down yesterday afternoon at Havana Airport, a couple of busy days, and then off to Argentina. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Tell us what you think about this visit. Chris, if I can go back to you, I know that there are issues of property claims, and these would be Cubans that left the country, many of them, of course, coming to the United States. And if there are more normalized relations between these two countries, do those property claims move up front and central and become a big issue?
That is an issue. Certainly, the wave of expropriations that Fidel Castro engaged in after coming to power seized lands and properties and houses of Cubans and Americans. Now, the one issue is that under U.S. law, only U.S. citizens or U.S. corporations can claim any rights over those properties. So a lot of the Cubans that had their properties seized cannot claim any sort of retribution or from those expropriated properties. And so the bulk of them, consequently, are actually U.S. corporations. Uh-huh. Corporations like United Fruit, or what used to be United Fruit, what is now Dole, Chiquita. A number of them also mining companies, Exxon Mobil, all have claims. Chevron, or what used to be Texaco, have claims. A lot of those companies actually they've written off those assets a long time ago. They were not on the books. I think a lot of them are willing to negotiate the claims first to sort of get first dibs on investment within Cuba, second to be able to maybe even buy bonds. So there's some room for maneuver there. It's the Cuban Americans, which represent a very small amount of claims, they obviously want also back in, and we're seeing even some of the largest Cuban American families or Cuban, landed elite, such as the Bacardis or the Fanjuls, which are huge sugar owners inside Cuba, beginning to also engage in their own negotiations with the Cuba government. And they want some of them just want some symbolic payback, their own family house back or some of their land. So I think this is not going to be as big a sticking point as many have feared, in part because, again, this generational change has taken over and most people have sort of written them off. And we'll see what happens, but I think it's not as big a point as many have feared.
An email from a listener, why pour any money into Cuba when our own islands like Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands fiscal needs go unmet? Forget those commies. Email from Fred, we have good relations with Saudi Arabia, China, and many other nations who have little freedom and are guilty of massive human rights violations. Selective outrage at Cuba, to my way of thinking, is the height of hypocrisy. Just to get a feel for what folks are thinking about, let me get Oren from Jameson to join us. And Oren, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, hi, Marty. Thanks very much for having me.
Sure.
I grew up in Miami at that time. In fact, I traveled to Cuba before Castro with my parents. But I was in junior high school when the first Cuban wave, refugee wave, came in. And initially, they were very welcomed. The American people were very proud of taking in these refugees. But within a year or two, attitudes started to change. The Cubans abused their welcome, at least in the eyes of the indigenous American people. The other thing is the black community was really badly handled. They thought initially that the Cuban refugees would move into the lowest economic and social scales and blacks would rise up. And in fact, the Cubans were just leapfrogged over the black community, and the blacks became enraged. And I think a lot of the riots in the 70s and 80s had their roots in that. But the Cubans would move into a neighborhood, and then they would pretty much take it over, and they'd park their cars on the lawns and started to make things look sort of slum-like. And attitudes changed among the indigenous Americans, and they moved out of Miami, and then they sort of took political power by incorporating Miami into the greater metropolitan Dade, where they held the majority. But in Miami, the majority was Cuban.
Well, you know what, Oren, let me take your comments, and only because I'm looking at John, he's sitting across from here. And any thoughts to Oren's comments?
It's actually touches on a new book I'm working on that looks at Cubans and Cuban Americans in the 1960s in Miami. It's really interesting. As he rightly says, there's a clash between populations, African Americans in Miami, with more Cubans coming into Miami, begin to feel that they're being pinched a bit by the federal government. The federal government is welcoming and providing services for Cuban refugees, and African Americans are still not enjoying the federal entitlements as citizens of the U.S. that Cuban refugees are. But what's also interesting at the same time is you have African Americans, particularly on the left in the early 60s, by the mid 60s, and certainly by the late 1960s, that are champions of a Cuba under Fidel Castro. And there are many African American leftists that go to Cuba during the 1960s seeking a kind of socialist utopia. Many come away disillusioned from that experience, but the power of the rhetoric of the Cuban Revolution in left-wing politics in the United States is something that is very much doing the opposite of what's happening on the ground in Miami between black and Cuban populations.
Well, I'll tell you what, only because we're almost up on a break here, let me just quickly reintroduce everybody and tell our listeners what we're talking about. Frankly, talking about what a lot of people are talking about today. I see my TV showing the President and Raul Castro in Havana this morning. We are talking about President Obama's historic visit to Cuba. And again, that's John Gronbeck Tedesco, an associate professor, convener of American Studies at Ramapo College of New Jersey, author of Cuba, the United States, and Cultures of the Transnational Left. Christopher Sabatini joining us from the NPR studios in New York. He's a professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, also director of a new research institute called Global Americans. And rounding out our trio of guests is David Rennie. He's the Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join the conversation. Stay with us. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. And again, I'm Marty Moscowen talking with David Rennie and Christopher Sabatini and John Gronbeck Tedesco about Cuba, U.S.-Cuba relations. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. David, let me go back to you. I know you have to leave us in about 5 or 6 or 7 minutes here. I'm wondering about the special status the Cuban immigrants have had in the United States and whether that would change if U.S.-Cuba relations change in any dramatic way going forward?
It's a very good question, and it kind of links in with your earlier good question about whether the current atmosphere of anti-trade rhetoric could play into the Cuba debate. I think actually trade at the moment, the idea that people are frightened of having their jobs taken away by Cuba, that's a while away because the Cuban economy is just in such terrible shape. But what you are seeing is that throughout the Cold War, there was this legal assumption, I mean, that is the basis of the legal treatment of Cubans, that every Cuban that makes it to American soil, obviously not the ones who are at sea, if they're intercepted at sea, they're sent back in this strange wet foot, dry foot policy that exists. But if you make it to American soil, you are treated as if you are a political refugee from communism. And that used to be pretty simple. Everyone who came over looked like an exile. Like the first waves had had their houses and property taken away way back in the early days of the revolution. But you've seen over the last 15, 20 years a real divide in that Cuban-American community, particularly in places like Miami, between that first wave of exiles and the people who are coming much more recently. Because the older exiles who remained absolutely implacable in their opposition to the Castros and would say that they were never going to set foot on their home island again while Castro was still alive, the newer arrivals, who were also given the same special instant immigration status, access to American benefits the moment they arrived, and then a year and a day after making landfall, they could get a green card, and then eventually citizenship, so a very privileged status for Cubans. Those younger arrivals who got that privileged status on the basis that they had been treated like political refugees, were then seen going back on the plane and visiting their families and taking, you know, clothes and baby clothes and baby milk back to their families and saying, well, you know, we want to look after our families and help them. You've had stories in the Florida press in the last year, which caused a huge political stink in Florida, about a small number of people kind of basically scamming the system, claiming American Social Security but living in Havana like kings because it's much cheaper to live in Havana. Hard to say that someone is a political refugee when they're behaving like that. What you've seen is some of the most hardline Cuban-American Republican politicians, including Senator Marco Rubio, saying, actually, this looks like abuse. And so we need to change this special status and start thinking about rewriting all of the immigration laws. That's really new.
Chris, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think what we're looking at here is, you know, the wet foot, dry foot policy is problematic. And what is happening is a number of the opponents of Obama's policy have begun to, the hardliners are beginning to sort of muse openly, well, maybe we should think about, you know, overturning this. And that's beginning to send an uptick of refugees to the United States and sort of has created sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that a lot of these people are now saying, well, see, Obama's policy hasn't created hope and change inside the island because so many people want to flee. But they're really playing a double game. I think Obama needs, you know, in Cuba now to sort of tap that. He's talked about this, tap this idea of hope and change and a future inside Cuba in a way that will sort of stoke, I think, people's optimism about the future and really sort of hopefully build the process for change within Cuba.
Let me get Manny to join our conversation. Hi, Manny. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times joining us from Philadelphia.
How you doing? Excellent show.
Thank you.
I'm Cuban-American, but I was raised and born here. Very strong ties to the island still. Just 2 points I want to bring up. I think time has kind of made us forget of why the embargo exists and exactly who the Castro dictatorship is and what they've done to the Cuban people and what their rhetoric and sentiment has been for the past 60 years. In hating the United States. And I have cousins who were raised every day in school, and they were taught to hate the United States. It was in educational material in schools. They marched. Everything was anti-U.S. It was like their obsession with the United States and hating the United States. And every foe or every mishap that happened in Cuba was because of the United States, and continues now because it's an inefficient economy. There's nothing. On that note, every single national of a communist dictatorship or a communist country that was under the Cold War got the same concessions that Cuban Americans get. So it's no different. Perhaps now it's not as political as it was, but let's not forget that. Hungarians, Polish, Russians, anyone that's affected was giving the same benefits that Cuban Americans were. The difference is that they're all in Miami.
Well, man, no, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And actually, John, if I can toss that back to you, and I don't discount what Manny says. There's certain level of anti-Cubanism certainly coming from this country.
Yeah, and you know, the point that Manny raised about how anti-Americanism is sort of ensconced in the Cuban educational apparatus is certainly correct. However, if you talk to everyday Cubans, the sort of mainstream comment you'll get is, why did it take so long for the United States to come to the table? In other words, there's a predominant feeling on the island that this embargo is U.S.-driven. We've been open to discussions. There was, in the 1970s, under the presidency of Jimmy Carter, a hint at a reconciliation. Some things were put in place that hadn't existed prior, but that ended up leading nowhere. But most Cubans, you know, say, you know, we've been here, and it's now wonderful to see that finally a U.S. president's willing to take the steps to do what's needed.
Can I just step in there, Marty, quickly?
Yeah, hold on just 1 second, only because David has to leave us in about 2 minutes.
Okay.
Let me give David a chance, a quick response before we say goodbye to you, and then, Chris, I'll get you back in.
Okay.
Well, just to that very good point the last caller made, this is a wicked regime. It's not the most wicked regime on earth, and it's not North Korea, but it is a wicked regime. It's a dictatorship. I've been several times and interviewed dissidents, some of whom have ended up in prison. The Economist magazine does not like the Castro regime. But the problem is, this embargo, for one thing, hasn't worked. It's had more than 50 years to work, and it hasn't worked. So when something doesn't work for half a century, carrying on is not that logical. The other thing is, it's been the most amazing excuse. Because when you go to Cuba, there's tons and tons of European investment, Mexican investment, Canadian investment. So actually, the reason the Cuban economy is such a mess is not a total absence of foreign money. It's a ridiculously bad government with terrible economic policies. But they could always tell their own people, of course our economy is in bad shape because the Americans are crushing us. So if you were to take away the embargo, the Castros, we believe at The Economist, would lose their single biggest excuse and would be then confronted with their own colossal mismanagement of the economy.
Well, David Rennie, thank you so much for joining us today on this very important historic day.
Thank you.
And he's the Washington Bureau Chief, Lexington columnist of The Economist. Christopher Sabatini and John Grunbeck-Tedesco staying with us for the rest of the hour. 1-888-477-9499. Chris, you wanted to add something.
Just one thing quickly is yes, it's true that the propaganda apparatus of the Cuban regime, and I want to underscore what David said, is this is a repressive government. It has sort of stoked anti-Americanism and built that up. But the truth is that, you know, having 2 million Cubans in the United States or Americans of Cuban descent has really sort of broken down a lot of those barriers. The Cuban government may try to instill this sense of anti-Yankeeism, but the flow of communications, the number of Cubans, there are over a million Cuban Americans that travel to Cuba now on a regular basis. It has undermined that sense of anti-Americanism. You can see this and if you travel to Cuba, America is very much fixed in the Cuban mind as a place of aspiring to go to, mimicking and so on, that I think is very important and I think that Obama is trying to build on. So yes, there is anti-Americanism. It goes back to Guantanamo Bay. It goes back to the Platt Amendment. It goes back to the Bay of Pigs. But at the same level, especially for a newer generation of Cuban Americans, it is a place that many people hold in high esteem.
John, you wanted to add
something. Yeah, I think the point Christopher's making is really important. You know, Cuba is also 90 miles away. So it means that the Cuban government can only do so much in preventing communications. For instance, people pirate satellite TV. They've been able to have internet. This isn't, in my mind, it's not the distance that a North Korean population has, for example. There's so much back and forth that's been going on that Cubans are in the know, even though it's been very difficult for them to sometimes get the information and certainly difficult for them to get the everyday resources. But there's been lots in place to really undermine what the Cuban government's been trying to do. But I just want to add also, it's been that proximity that's also allowed for a flexibility in the revolution that many people don't point to.
Such as?
Well, most people in the United States, we think that the Cuban Revolution is the same in 2016 as it was in 1960. And that's true in some ways, but not true in many other ways. The Cuban Revolution has evolved because it's had to. It's faced different economic obstacles, social obstacles, cultural obstacles, like any nation does, and has had to adapt. And so the back and forth nature between Cuba and the United States of this massive population that's brought money, that's brought information, that's brought technology, has allowed in some ways the revolution to perhaps go farther than it might have without this proximity.
Interesting. Let me get Ernie from Philadelphia to join our conversation. Ernie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, so one of your guests mentioned that African-Americans on the left that long supported Cuba. I'm one of those African-American leftists that just happened to visit Cuba on a media and communications worker, a cultural worker tour 2 weeks after the Mariel boat lift.
Oh, wow.
And we had a chance to meet with cultural workers, writers, radio and TV workers. And we challenged them from the left, and black leftists, on the so-called absence of racism. Although I personally, directly, although my Spanish is not good, talked with people who had, black people, who had definitely directly benefited from the Cuban Revolution. And they spoke of their pre-revolutionary experience versus their post-revolutionary experience in terms of economic and educational opportunities. I was wondering what your guest has seen currently in the status of the Afro-Cuban population, which I believe is still the majority of the population.
Ernie, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. That was something you said, John, but let me toss that first to Chris, and then I want to hear what you say about that as well. Chris, you want to respond to Ernie's question?
Yeah, that's a good question, Ernie, and appreciate you pointing out sort of the hypocrisy of the revolution in many ways. If you look at the Politburo of the Cuban government, there's hardly an African-American, Afro-Cuban on the Politburo. It's a very white revolution that did provide educational and health and housing benefits to Cuba's majority Afro-descendant population. What's happened recently, and John sort of alluded to this, is that the flood of remittances that have come into Cuba, last count is about $3 billion in the last year. They're coming primarily from Cubans who fled of more European descent. And that is creating a disparity inside Cuba of economics and entrepreneurship. Many of the entrepreneurs we're talking about and celebrating are of more European descent. Their capital comes from relatives living overseas. So what we're seeing, troublingly, is a disparity between those of more European descent and those of more African descent on the island. And that is going to raise a huge issue in terms of the future of political change and political inclusion on the island. And it is very troubling even to the Castro regime to see this. And I think, again, I want to refer back to this. There are many potential problems with Obama's visit. But if he can speak, you know, as the first African-American president in the United States to those two Afro-descendants in Cuba and talk about sort of their rights as well, I think it'll be a very powerful moment. But it is, you know, it is not a racism is not over with, and equality is not persistent in Cuba right now, that has very strong racial lines.
Go ahead, John.
Yeah, Ernie, I appreciate the question. I think it's an important one and one that's talked about quite a bit in academic circles, but I'm not sure how much the mainstream press picks up on this point. So the answer is kind of both. Many Afro-Cubans will say that things did get better beginning in the 1960s. If you look at the 1950s and before, if you look at, say, Batista's presidency and social conditions on the island prior to 1960, you'll see a lot of Jim Crow-style segregation that was rampant throughout Cuba. You'll see mostly, if not exclusively, white Cubans enjoying positions of power in government, in tourism, in all sort of rank-and-file jobs. That begins to change with the revolution, and more Afro-Cubans are able to get to positions, social positions, educational positions that were cut off to them prior. That said, certainly the revolution is not living up to the ideals it espouses with respect to race and racism in Cuba. And one of the reasons is exactly as Chris points out, is the disparity, the income disparity, the economic disparity that happens from tourism. When tourists, European tourists, Canadian tourists, even Asian tourists, when they go to Cuba, are they going to stay with a black family or are they going to stay with a white family? If it's a private, what's called a casa particular, which is a private residency that's used as a kind of hostel or a hotel, you know, those racial disparities are also coming from without. They're not just on the island. It's part of kind of the global economy and how race and racism operates economically throughout the world. So the point's a good one.
Well, there is so much more to talk about, but the clock is telling me we are out of time. My thanks to both of you so much for joining us today in Radio Times. John Grunbeck-Tedesco, thanks for taking the train down and joining us here in the studio.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Associate Professor, Convener of American Studies at Ramapo College of New Jersey, author of Cuba, the United States and Cultures of the Transnational Left. Christopher Sabatini, thank you so much for joining us in Radio
Times.
Thanks,
Marty.
And joining us from the NPR studios in New York, professor at Columbia University School of International and Public Affairs, also director of a new research institute, Global Americans. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We did take some photos, which we will post on our Facebook page. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back.